this week's 51%, we'll speak with a political scientist who works to give more women in the field a voice.
We've been having a lot of women come up to us and say, you know, I never said yes to media before, but you guys have empowered me to say yes. And so now I'm saying yes when journalists want to interview me.
And we hear about support and advocacy for domestic workers in Texas. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. For the battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Often when we're talking about women in science, we're talking about physics, molecular biology, or chemistry, those kinds of sciences. But what about political science? Where are the female political scientists when it comes to media or academia? Kathleen Searles and fellow female political scientists got tired of wondering and took action. Searles sits on the editorial board of Women Also Know Stuff, an initiative to promote and publicize the work and expertise of scholars in political science who identify as women. There's a searchable database to help academics and journalists identify and connect with women academics conducting research on a multitude of issues related to the study of politics. Searles is an assistant professor of political communication with a joint appointment in the Political Science Department and Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. Her research examines the content of partisan news, poll coverage, and the influence of emotional appeals in campaign ads.
Primarily made up of men, particularly in the academic side. So in faculty positions are still primarily men in political science. And what we see is actually that as you go up, there are fewer and fewer women. So we're almost at parity when you look at political science graduate programs, but there are fewer when you look at assistant professor, political scientists, and then even fewer when you look at people that have tenure, and far fewer when you look at people that are what we call full professors, which is sort of the top that you can achieve in terms of a faculty member. So it's part of the problem. And the other thing that we see a lot, and this is for news outlets in general, is that oftentimes reporters will seek out male sources for politics. And so I think part of the problem is not only are there fewer women in political science academia, but also politics is often seen, whether we realize it or not, as a very male domain. And so there might be this inadvertent tendency to look towards men to speak about issues that we perceive as being more masculine.
So how do you change this? What are you doing?
It's very difficult to change, but there are some things that people are working on, including the Women Also Know Stuff organization. The thing that we are trying to do to help, you know, increase the number of women sources in the news, particularly around politics, is that we created a website that was crowdsourced. So women experts in political science can sign up for the website and then have their profile on the website. And the idea was that oftentimes, reporters, news outlets might want to source a woman, might have the best intentions to source a woman, but when you sit down and you're under deadline, you just can't think of one, you don't know one, the people that you're talking to are primarily men, they refer other men, and that's your network. So we wanted to have a place where reporters that would like to increase the diversity of their sources could go and easily just search for a key term, something that they're reporting on, a story that came up, a current event, and then find a woman expert that is an expert in this area that can speak to the issue or the news article that they're working on. Just make it a little bit easier because we know everybody's busy. The news cycle, particularly right now, just nonstop. Anything we can do to make it just a little bit more of a nudge towards trying to increase the diversity of your sources is in my book, a positive. And I think many reporters have also seen it as a real net benefit.
So how did Women Also Know Stuff get started? And how's it faring? What are the trends?
Sure. So we started in 2016. Our founder is Samara Klar. She's an assistant professor at University of Arizona, although I think she just got tenure. So let's say she's an associate professor. It's very exciting. We're all very happy for her. Basically, our friend Samara was looking at an article that had a headline that we saw a lot in 2016 that was something along the lines of, we asked 10 political scientists what their opinion was on X. And she opened it, as many of us do, eagerly like looking to see if she knew anybody that was quoted or sourced of these 10 political scientists. and saw immediately that all of the political scientists that were quoted were men, and in addition, they were all white men. And these are two of the issues that we often face when we're talking about sourcing diversity. And she just kind of was frustrated and said, you know, there are lots of people studying this, myself included, many of my friends that are women or people of color, and why aren't they included in this article? And so she sent out an email to just a few of her close friends, myself included, and other editorial board members, and said, you know what, I'm tired of being upset about this. I'm tired of being frustrated about this. Why don't we make something that makes it easier for reporters who also care about diversity of their sources to consult women experts when there's a story that's relevant? And we started a sort of rough website. At first, it was very kind of casual, you know, providing the logger info for people we knew that would want to be on the website, that were also political scientists and experts that were interested in supporting this effort. And quickly, the response was so overwhelming that we had to organize. So we created an editorial board. We solicited the help of people that were good with websites, that helped build out a more professional looking website. We invested in the infrastructure of it so that we could be equipped to handle larger numbers of people on the website. And now we also have a very large social media presence. I think we're up to 17,000 followers on Twitter, which is another arm of the organization that helps promote women's work. But basically that was the story, you know, just one of my friends, Samara, said no more, you know, I'm not going to be upset about this anymore. This is not going to be a thing that we just kind of complain about over cocktails. Let's make this better. And so then it was born, and we've just been overwhelmed and blown away by the support, not just from reporters who write to us all the time that they were using the source, using it for sources, and all, from all over the world, in fact, people using the site to find women for certain areas. But what has been also really rewarding and perhaps unanticipated is that we've been having a lot of women come up to us and say, you know, I never said yes to media before, but you guys have empowered me to say yes. And so now I'm saying yes when journalists want to interview me. And it's been really rewarding. And my institution is also really happy that I am saying yes. And I feel like I feel more safe to be part of this space and be part of this conversation and put myself out there. And that's also been a huge part of this and something that has just been immensely rewarding for all of us at Women Also Knows Dust.
Well, that's really interesting. Why do you think some women don't want to opine in the press?
I think women in general have a lot of challenges they face when we're talking about saying yes to media requests. One of them is that often women bear the brunt of childcare or whatever kind of care. And so their schedules might be a little bit difficult and might not always match up with reporters. Also, oftentimes reporters are on deadline and they need a response right away. But women often in the workplace bear the brunt of service and sort of other kind of housekeeping duties that often mean they're not as available. On top of that, women are socialized to believe that they can only speak as an expert on something if they know all of the things, right? So I've had women that come up to me and say, I was saying no to media requests on, foreign policy because I didn't think I was enough of an expert to speak to this. But then I realized I had already written two books on this, and that was crazy. And so part of this challenge is making sure that women recognize that they may have been socialized to believe that they need to know everything before they can say anything, but that oftentimes the expertise is there. They just need that extra confidence boost to say yes.
Since the launch of Women Also Know Stuff in 2016, there's been an interesting political landscape here in the United States, and one of your areas of expertise is campaign ads. And I'm wondering, as we gear up for midterm elections, what you're seeing, especially with such an increase in the number of women running for political office.
Yeah, so it's a very exciting time politically. It's certainly exciting for people that study politics, but also sort of an overwhelming time because we won't know for some time if this is sort of a blip in terms of political history or if this is kind of a new way of doing things. And either way, it's very exciting to be kind of an observer in this. But one of the things I'm particularly looking out for as somebody that studies both women in news and also campaign ads is obviously we have what some people are calling a wave of women, but what I would better describe as more attention around women running for office and a surge in women feeling empowered to run for office, which is really exciting. And one of the things we know is that There's something called a role model effect. So when women run for office, when women are visible in politics, then young women that are watching that at home then feel like politics is their place. It changes their political attitudes, and then they become more politically efficacious. So then they're more likely to participate in politics. And I see the same sort of pattern in the news, right? So in our little niche of this movement with trying to increase the number of women in sources, when you have women that are saying yes more, when you have women that are feeling more empowered in the space, that are more likely to participate in interviews and then be present as an expert in all these different kinds of articles and all these different types of stories, then hopefully we're having the same sort of effect that, you know, young women are reading this and young men as well and seeing women as experts. So we see a sort of nice parallel here between more women running for office, women more visible in the political sphere, hopefully women, people seeing women as part of this discourse and part of this public conversation, and hopefully the same also happening in other domains, in other areas of expertise, people seeing women as part of this conversation. Because ultimately, women in the public space, women as experts, that means that women's voices are part of the conversation, that they're there at the table when we're talking about policy, and that affects all of us. And I think it's pretty non-controversial to say that we want women to be at the table, that we want 50% of our population to be present when we're talking about the things that affect us the most.
So part of your research is in the influence of emotional appeals in campaign ads. And I'm wondering what you think we're going to be seeing or what we are seeing in campaign ads this year on the heels of Me Too, Time's Up, and, you know, just women speaking out more against sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and harassment in general.
So I was reading the other day about a candidate that is over and over again expressing that this is personal for her. And that struck me as very interesting because traditionally what we see is that women downplay their feminine attributes because they've been told that those are not part of the political domain and that those are not strategic, those won't help them. So often women are told that they should upplay their stereotypically masculine attributes, that they should act more like men do, and then that's how they're successful. But I think because of the Me Too movement, because of the surge in women running, that there is more comfort around this idea that women can run as themselves, that they can acknowledge that they have both stereotypically masculine and stereotypically feminine traits, that all of those are important in politics, and that there can hopefully be sort of a rewriting of this narrative that women should run as men, but men can run however they want. There's a lot to be seen because the data we have on this, the research we have on this, is from previous years where there's not as many women candidates, and traditionally women have not always had as much success depending on the kind of level of the race, of course. But there is a sort of cultural moment happening at the same time that seems to be empowering women candidates to embrace the fact that they're a woman, that they may or may not be a mom, that they may or may not be have different sexual orientations, and talk about that as being part of what makes them viable for this position, part of what makes them uniquely qualified to be in the political domain, rather than downplaying that and acting more like a male candidate might. And we're seeing a lot of ads that are kind of echoing these same themes that I'm a woman, I'm complicated, I'm not necessarily all the stereotypical feminine traits, nor am I going to pretend like I'm a stereotypical male candidate. I am a person, and here are all the things about me that make me qualified to run. I'm just like your neighbor, and I care about this community, right? And so that's very different from where maybe we've seen before either women go all the way towards where I'm a mom and there's this sort of Patty Murray, I'm a mom in tennis shoes image, or our candidates kind of shirk all the feminine qualities entirely and act more like male candidates. I think we're seeing more of a complicated image emerge from this moment. And it's really interesting to watch, but we don't know whether or not that will be successful yet. I think it may.
Katie, what about attack ads? Are we going to see a change in those as well in terms of who's putting them out? I mean, it seems that maybe men have more of the attack ads than women. Women focus more on their accomplishments or what they'd like to accomplish. I don't know. That could be completely untrue. I'm just asking you what the trends are or may be.
Traditionally, women have been more reticent to go negative because of this sort of fear that will look not feminine, that will not comport with how voters like to see women candidates. But given that we're sort of seeing all of these sort of traditional misnomers about how women should run being challenged at this moment, there's I would say a very real chance that we'll see more women go on the negative, go on the attack. And that's not a bad thing, right? I think as voters we hear, oh, candidates go on the attack as being an overall negative thing for us. But what we know from the research is that negative ads actually help people learn better than positive ads, and that negative ads are more memorable. So certainly for a candidate, it is better to have all of those sort of ads and all of those sort of strategies in your toolbox. And if you're a woman, of course you should be able to use both negative and positive ads, whatever will help your base learn most about you. And in some cases, that might be negative. In particular, if the other candidate is already going negative against you, that needs to be a way that you should feel comfortable responding. One of the things we saw kind of flipped on its head in 2016 is oftentimes the kind of trope was that women avoid emotional ads because they don't want to see sort of playing to feminine traits. But we actually saw Hillary have primarily emotional ads in 2016, whereas Trump did not have as emotional ads, even though we may think, because we think of him as being sort of over the top and being larger than life, surprisingly, his ads were primarily policy, or much more so policy based than hers. So we might see that in 2018 as well, that female candidates sort of embrace the strategy of the emotional appeal, whether it's more positive emotions like enthusiasm and hope, or more negative emotions like anger and fear, which also can be very effective.
That was Kathleen Searles, assistant professor of political communication with a joint appointment in the Political Science Department and Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. She's on the editorial board of Women Also Know Stuff, an initiative to promote and publicize the work and expertise of scholars in political science who identify as women. The site also provides a list of websites representing women in other fields and professions. An analysis by the Associated Press finds that many state lawmakers accused of sexual misconduct in the Me Too era are having success running for re-election or new legislative seats. Roughly 24 of the 70 state lawmakers who have been publicly accused of sexual misconduct are running for re-election or another office this year. Of those, 15 have already advanced to the November 6th general election. Kelly Dittmar, an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, says the relative political success of accused state lawmakers suggests that voters are unsure how to respond. That is true even in states where voters have a history of supporting female politicians and traditionally liberal issues. Next, we'll hear a piece from Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife. It's about immigration and labor, this time domestic labor, and a group in San Antonio that supports and advocates for women in this work.
Well, I wouldn't like to remember this. A group of people brought me and promised to pay me a salary, and they did not keep their promise. The woman told me I would have everything, which did not happen. I did not leave Sundays. I would work from Monday to Monday. I didn't have breaks. I wouldn't eat well. I was very skinny. She would say that I should eat when her family and husband were present. But when they would leave, she would check my food. She would check everything. And later someone called the police. I would talk with other girls who also worked like me in housekeeping. One of them called the police. They picked me up. They rescued me. It was Araceli, Iracema. They rescued me. And thanks to them, I am here with them, because they have supported me very much.
You just heard the voice of Gloria. Like so many domestic workers, she felt isolated and powerless. Gloria was promised reasonable wages as a maid for a family, but instead was cheated and demoralized. Gloria was freed with the help of Domesticas Unidas. We sat down with Iracema Cavazos, who is an activist for Domesticas Unidas. Here is Iracema talking about the work they do.
Because domestic work is always considered women's work, and therefore it's undervalued and not respected, and women are not given the dignity. So that's who we organize. Women who clean houses independently, who take care of the children in people's homes, work as nannies, those ladies who take care of the elderly and disabled in private homes. They are predominantly immigrant women and women of color.
Domesticas Unidas offers training for members to improve their work. This also empowers the community of domestic workers.
We want to give them the tools that will empower them. And part of that is communication. So we have conversational English classes. We have Know Your Rights classes. And then classes to deal with their emotional trauma and how to do the job that they're doing, how to clean, for instance, using non-toxic products to protect their health. And then on children, we have a class coming up on how to do childcare, the psychological. And it's very interesting how today our immigrant children are being traumatized and how we're going to have classes to help these women who work as nannies respect the child and know the psychological growth that a child goes through and how to treat them.
While they do serious advocacy work, the meetings are also a time to celebrate.
I remember when this woman from Colombia, one of our members, talked about the cumbia. And she said, you know, everybody loves the cumbia. Wow, you just get all emotional and turned on. It's so beautiful. We can learn from each other. So she taught us something. We have a saying here at our organization and the National Domestic Workers Alliance as well, that domestic workers do the work that makes all other work possible. Just to think about it, an attorney to get out the door, okay, and exercise their profession, okay, has somebody at home. The word care, for instance, we consider that domestic workers care. They care for your home. They care for what's most valuable to all of us. What's the greatest value that we have? Our home. And we then give over the home to this woman who comes and takes care of our home. Our children. We turn our children over to them, and they take care of our children. Our most loved elderly parents, grandparents, we hand them over to them as well. So we are a caring community. We have to do it with joy, okay? And that is also part of resistance. I mean, if we do our work in misery, who's winning? These are educated women. These are powerful women. They have crossed continents, okay, with nothing. And these are powerful women.
This story was produced by Kim Belsick and Lauren Fryer, with assistance from Carlos Salazar and Bern Rock, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
Show for this week, thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1514.